Hemshachayim Beis, we're up to chapter Kuf Chav Tes, 129, page Deish Mem Tes, 149. Discussion here is about the purpose of divine energy, if we can classify it as such. Which means that the Rebbe Rashab asked the question in the last chapter. We understand, to use the example, how the cosmic artist, why he uses what we call a focused, targeted energy. That's focused and targeted like a paintbrush to create a piece of art. In this case, existence. So he uses what we call Er HaGvul, that's the focused energy that's focused. Create structure. It's a structured world, so you need a structured instrument. What are the divine instruments? Chachma, Bina, Das, Chesed, Gvur, Teferes, Netzach, Hei, Yisemach. So forget now about the meaning of these words. Just think of them as the building blocks. Just like there's a cellular structure and there's a subatomic structure, the spiritual structure behind all of existence, the energy that makes it tick, is a defined energy. It's chesed and so on. And the configurations of these 10 building blocks is what defines everything in existence. You know, the most simplest so-called alloy is fire and water. So fire is gvura as it manifests in the physical. And the water is chesed as it manifests in the physical. Okay. So that type of energy is clear. If you want a world, and based on, of course, God can do anything he wants, but based on a structure like he created that's logical, and wants it to be logical, as I read from the Tzemach Tzedek yesterday, that the world as it is tells us this is why the way God wanted it. So if he wants a world like this, that should be somewhat sensible with the logic that he created. And of course, again, I say if, because he could have created a different logic and could have been that 2 plus 2 equals 5 and not 4. Or that there was no 2 plus 2 altogether, for that matter. So in such a structure, the finite energy has a very specific role. It is the energy that defines and shapes existence. But no different than if you wanted to right now make a picture on a piece of paper. So though your hand and your mind can come up with all kinds of millions of different variations, but if you want to make a human being, you have to make a head, a body, and legs, or a horizon, or a sunset, or whatever it may be. So what you're doing is taking your energy, so to speak, and confining it, targeting it, focusing it toward particular, tailoring it to these particular parameters. That's the purpose of what he calls Er HaGvul, Er Pnimi. I specifically didn't use those words when I started, because as soon as you hear Er Makif, Er Pnimi, right away, everybody's, all kinds of buttons are pressed and say, oh, that's Er Pnimi that I learned. It's better actually not to know anything to be able to fully relate to it. But use the example of the artist, everyone relates to that. Of course, you need energy focus. If I want to write words, I want to write a particular message, I can't write a million words, I have to write a few sharp words. It's the secret of copywriting, actually. Copywriting, real copywriting, is taking a lot of ideas and putting it into short, one headline. That's a very focused, that's Er HaGvul at its best, so to speak, in the human example of it. Then comes Er HaBligvul. Er HaBligvul is, as the words that he uses in here, is Gili Min HaEtzem. Its role is not creating, is not focusing and targeting and giving you a message. It's not trying to create a piece of art. It's just trying to express the source's energy. It's just whatever comes out of you. So it would be like an equivalent of if a targeted type of writing exercise would be write a paper on, let's say, what does a sunset look like? A Gili Min HaEtzem or Bligvul would be just free, just, what do they call it? Free association, just talk. Say what's on your heart. That would be unfettered and unlimited by any parameters. I'm just using a human example. In the divine, it's basically Gili Min HaEtzem. It doesn't have any focused purpose except revealing what the source wants. Now, in the case of an artist, that would be like the artist first needs to desire to do art. What kind of art? That's really the focused energy. But the so-called reflective energy that's reflecting, expressing his etzem, that's just, I want to express myself in art now. And then comes, within that arises, or he puts a shir atzmei bekeach, the artist envisions, foresees, and estimates, what would I need to now focus my art to a particular message, theme, and so on. Clear? So the question in the last chapter was, so what's the purpose of this Gili Min HaEtzem? You can't say that it has to be there, because God, Atzmus, doesn't need air. A sun must shine. Atma doesn't need to reveal himself. For what's his purpose? Why does he need to express himself, so to speak? So the Eir HaGvul, yeah, he wants a world, and the way he wants it, so he needs the energy to shape the existence. But what's the Gilui Min HaEtz? So Rebbe Rashab elaborates and says that you have to say there's a kavana. The kavana is also because of existence, but its purpose is the exact opposite of the purpose of the finite. The finite energy, its role is to shape existence. And the infinite energy, or the Eir HaBligvul, Eir HaMakif, whatever the words used there, Gilui Min HaEtzem, its role is to teach the worlds what God is like, and in a sense, basically weaken or even eliminate the yeshes of the world. Bitl, basically. It says Gilui Elokus Be'Elemus and Bitl Elemus. So this energy is also has a purpose. Its purpose, however, is not the shaping of existence, it's the teaching of existence that what you are is really bottled to something far greater than you. And then he explains that these two levels are really two levels in divine energy. One that expresses itself that is much more commensurate to the structure that he creates. So think of the artist. When you look at the piece of art, you say, okay, the artist that created this has the ability to create this piece of art. But you don't know much about the artist that did not create the art. You don't know about him outside of this piece of art. Even though, as we discussed, through the art you can extrapolate, and you can figure things out, you can deduce. But then comes a gili that comes from the artist himself, and that teaches you that this energy is a ha'arin of delis, as he put it. That's already like a step away from the artist's natural gili etzem, his just expressing himself. Then comes an energy of expressing himself, and that expressing himself does not have shape and form. Like he says, it's ayin amiti, it's real ayin. And this ayin amiti is what causes bitl into in existence. So there's a bitl that exists on the level that is... There is the energy that defines existence. And it also, there's a level of bitl, as he said, there's yesh ma'ayin, there's the ayin from the yesh anivra. Like, for example, that you see this work of art called life, existence, God put it here. So yes, you also have a measure of awe and sense, whoever put it here. But that's because you don't understand the source. So you call it ayin. Or he said, it's ayin because it's intangible. The table is tangible. The world is tangible. But that's not true ayin. That's just relative to our level. We understand there's something beyond us. So you look at a piece of art, you understand the artist must be far greater than me. So I have a certain respect for that. But then real ayin amiti is the energy that comes out of the source that is absolute true bittul. It's not just relative to our lack of understanding, because of our lack of understanding. That's essentially a summary of the last chapter. The end of the chapter, the Rebbe Hashab adds that the ayin of the yesh anivra, there's also ayin of the netzel. There's the ayin shel yesh anivra and the ayin of the netzel. Basically, like for example, Chochma Vatzilis, we've learned, also introduces bittul. Because Chochma, he brought from Tanya, senses that there's something beyond. Chochma senses the hula vade ve'en zulase, that there's nothing but him. Because Chochma has a sense of awe. Bina is yesh. Chochma's ayin, say, because Chochma senses something beyond. Bina understands, I understand. So there's the I, me. In Chochma, it's more the thing is being understood, so to speak, or the thing is being, I'm getting a transmission of intelligence coming into me. So you sense something's beyond. So Chochma senses a bittul, but it's a bittul, he says, that's still commensurate to the person. Because it's coming through wisdom and so on. It's coming because you sense it's connected. And then he says there's an ayin amiti. Ayin amiti is simply a revelation that has no particular focus function except revealing the source. But its purpose is to bring bittul into the worlds. So the interesting thing is all energy that flows out of the divine has a purpose. One's purpose is to shape existence. The other one's purpose is to elevate existence. And to elevate existence, it has to be an energy that's not shaped by anything. Because if it's shaped by something, it will then be again defined by that shape. So the paradox is, the Gilui Min HaEtzem, as much as it sounds like it's just expressing the essence, its purpose is actually to elevate existence. Is it clear what I said? You know, I mentioned Einstein said, and other physicists say, you cannot change a system from within itself. You'll see any pioneer in science, in medicine, in physics, wherever you go, always thought out of the box. They never use the rules that they saw, because if you use the existing structure, all you can do is extend it a little more, make it better. Like Ford said, when they asked him, what kind of market research did you do? You know, Steve Jobs repeated this when they asked him how much market research he does for his Apple products. Steve Jobs, Olav Ashalom, I should say, right? So he said, market research? None, zero. He says, people don't know what they want. And he quoted Ford, when he was asked how much market research he did when he did the Model T, the first automobile, he said, market research, if you ask people what they wanted, they'd say they want faster horses. Because you take the context, what you know, and say, I want more of it. I want a better machine. To create a different machine, you need to think outside of the system. You need to think, you have to basically be a dreamer. You have to have imagination. And you see all these people who have imagination. Look at Leonardo da Vinci, right? You see his drawings and stuff like that. It's unbelievable. Man was a complete fantasizer, but he fantasized things that became a reality. And a few others like that. Now, sometimes it's meshuggah, but as they say, even a broken clock is right twice a day. Now, I'm not saying they're broken clocks. On the contrary, I think people think out of the box. And, you know, the first person, people who thought about air flight, they had to be a little nuts, because no one flew. Birds flew. Human beings that tried to fly got killed. But they dreamt, and they dreamt, and they ultimately did it. And look, you see, you know, the time you take a plane takes off. Not only, I mean, you'd think a plane had to be light in order to defy gravity. The plane is tons, is hundreds, how heavy is a plane? Tens of tons for sure, right? But because they learned, they someone thought out of the box, so to speak. I'm using the example simply because when you talk about air, the same thing. Air HaGvul cannot transform Gvul. It can create Gvul, but it can't transform it. So you need a force that's more powerful than the system. So you need an energy that comes from outside of the system. That would be the Etzem Eir, the Gilimina Etzem Eir, that is the Eir HaBligvul. That transcendent energy exists here and allows us to basically challenge our own structures, which is why a human being can be pushed to go far beyond their so-called natural limits. Now, obviously, this doesn't mean you can suddenly fly physically, but you can create a plane that flies. So I would submit that if there was no Gili Mina Etzem, no Eir Ein Sof, no pioneering venture would be possible. Animals, for example, are controlled by Eir HaGvul. You find no animals innovating better shelters and better technologies to make their lives better. They're like a clock. They're satisfied with what they have, and actually they don't waver from it, but they also don't build it. They don't improve their situation. A human being can destroy, but also build. This is Eir HaBligvul in action. So it's not visible in the sense, doesn't manifest in the structure, but it manifests in the ability to transcend the structure.
Destruction also comes from the sir?
The ability to destroy. I wouldn't say it creates destruction. Yeah, I would say so. I think a person who has the energy is flowing inside them and they have nowhere to channel it, and it can turn into a
Muslim.
I don't know why you got to bring racism to the table here.
Not racism. Fact is fact.
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't say Bligville is to blame for the destruction of existence, but let's put it this way. Animals never destroy. It's humans that destroy. So that means they have, because they have this ability to touch that part. But
I was just wondering if the humans are responsible for imbalance in the order, but is it because of this art?
Yeah, I would say, yeah. He doesn't say this befeirish here, but I would say because humans have the Tzelem Elokim, so they have an element of the Eir HaBligvul, for sure. You have to say that. I mean, that's how I'm applying it here. Here he doesn't talk, he talks a little more theoretically, he talks more that the Bit La'ilim comes to Eir HaBligvul. But what does that mean? It means the ability to transform of existence in some way. Obviously the kavana here, the purpose here is in a positive way, to sublimate the yesh. In other words, the nobility of a human being to get out of their own narcissism and their own self-interest and to do something greater for the kavana, for the human race, is an example of some type of thing. It's a type of bittul. So now we're going to go to Kuf Chav Tes, and now the question is going to be, doesn't Eir Pnimi also cause Bittl? That's going to be the discussion here. But since I began something, I'd like to just say the following. You know, to me the goal of a class like this is not just to teach. It's to pass on to you what was passed on to me. I mean, I learned not the easy way. I didn't have someone that took me by the hand and said, here's how you learn Chassidus. But I struggled with it, and I try to access the best I could access. And of course the Rebbe himself. So the Rebbe was not a hands-on teacher in the sense you could just sit down and learn with him, but the Rebbe was a high-level teacher. Meaning if you showed an effort, and I think I did, I worked in the Sichas, I could say the Rebbe trained me in many ways. And it didn't take me by my hand and train me, but when we worked on the Sichas, every edit, all the edits the Rebbe made were like a master surgeon with a scalpel dissecting ideas. And I could tell you, I can't tell you how many things I learned from the precision. The Rebbe's sharp mind in just, you know, we used to present the Sikha, the Rebbe's own words, which was not an easy thing to do, because you're presenting to the Rebbe his words, not my words. Yeah, that's what I mean. Everything the Rebbe said, and then the Rebbe would edit it. So the first times I did it, it was quite a humbling experience, because, you know, sending it to the person who said it, forget about the Rebbe, let's say he was just a regular smart man, but especially the Rebbe, and did I accurately convey what you said? And so sometimes, most of them were from Shabbos and Yom Tov, where there was no tapes. Not that the tapes made it easier, by the way. The tapes only made it easier you had on paper. But have one of it, sometimes on paper, just because you had the tape didn't mean you understood it. It meant that you read it. Looks like, listen, this is the Rebbe Rashab himself wrote. This is when we understand it. It means that he wrote it. But from Shabbos was an additional challenge that everything was memory. So for all we knew, we didn't hear it right.
Did you listen in a different way during...
You can't even compare. I can chazer a few Fabrengas now almost word for word from Shabbos from 30 years ago. Weekday, I can't. I didn't apply myself that way, because I knew I could always rely on the tape. That's what I said. Without pressure, you don't... If there was no Shabbos in Yom Tov, I would never have used my mind the way I did. To me, that alone was worth the whole thing. And trust me, it was not easy. It's one of the most difficult things. I told you many times, one of the secrets of remembering is listening. We don't listen. And I didn't listen either. When the Rebbe spoke on a tape, I listened. Yeah, I heard what he said. But real listening is ability to shut off your processor and just absorb. Try that out. It's not so easy to do. The smarter you are, the harder it is.
How do you access hefty?
How do you access to do that? How do you do that?
Is there a technique to access what you
want? Well, if you're not a listener, like I just said, you know, it's not a problem. The problem is the first step, absorbing without processing. It's almost, you're not going to find very many people that can do it. I can tell in a second if someone can do it. You need real training for that. It doesn't happen automatic. You can't just say, oh, I'm not going to process. Because you understand, all your strengths come into motion. When you hear me speaking right now, all your processing switches are turning on, not off. Because you want to understand it. Instead, to shut off the processor means all you want to do is hear it and not understand it. That's not that simple.
Did Abba ever speak about these ideas about listening and did you what you did?
Yeah. There's an expression that Chassidus bring. I don't remember a talk where they said this is how you remember, but there's an expression Chassidus brings from Halacha, from Hilchos Treifus. I did the Torah Lemivla Leipolit. When you're busy absorbing, you cannot transmit. It's considered with the certain foods that are absorbers. When they're absorbing, they don't transmit.
Exude.
Yeah, they don't give off like taste. Certain things kosher and something non-kosher mixed with something kosher. It depends on the fruit and the food.
Liver.
Different.
Liver.
Spices. Certain spices. Salt. You know, there are things that are absorbers. There are things that are. Then there's the expression the other way around. Either the tarad lepolit lemivla. Something while you're busy transmitting, you can't be busy absorbing. It's simple. You and I have a conversation. If I'm speaking and you're listening, if I'm speaking and you're speaking, there's no absorbing going on. You know, like they say, the couple says after 30 years of marriage. So the woman says, "Well, before we got married, he did all the talking, and I did the listening. The first 10 years of our, first 20 years of our marriage." I did the talking and he did the listening. And now we both do the talking and the neighbors do the listening. You know? The bottom line is it's an art that can be trained, by the way. It's an absolute, can be trained. I've tested it. But it takes work. It's like real training. It's true mental training, and you completely use it, your mind completely differently. This to me, if I was running a school, would be one of the first things I would train students. The earlier the better, because before they develop bad habits, thinking habits. Most people don't think in an organized way. They don't think in a healthy way. The smarter the person is, the more destructive it can become. Why? Because when you're smart, you can get away with it. You get it. And you get it fast. That doesn't mean you're disciplined. Many people, when they communicate, you'll see they'll communicate page 3 before page 1. You can see right away. Even if they give you very good ideas, but they're not organized. That's immediately a sign someone that is smart, but they don't have the technique down pat. This is one of the reasons I think university is a good thing. They make you write. They make you write and write and write and write. For no reason. If you think about it, why do you have to write so many papers? Well, there is a reason. Because it forces you to communicate your ideas. It forces someone else to read your ideas and to mark them. Did you convey what you're saying? Because most people have, like you could say right now, I think I get it. If someone asks you, say it, you'll be hard-pressed. You'll say it's not so easy to communicate. There are things we get all the time, and then someone says, and you tell someone, I heard yesterday something unbelievable. Can you share with me? You'll be very few words you'll have. You'll just, because you didn't really integrate it. It was not internalized. It was not, you processed, and you probably didn't absorb it. That's what happens, most likely. And so, why am I saying it? Because the key is almost knowing how to clean your slate and listen to something. And you could always bring your information in later. It's not like when I did this, it's not like I listened. On Sunday, Monday, when I started researching, of course I brought my knowledge into it. And then I did process. But it's in a different stage. It's like when you do research, when you're doing research, you don't say you want to research whatever, a business. You want to invest, or you want to research a subject matter. So what does a wise person do? You gather information. You Google it, or you look into books. You start collecting information. Usually you're going to get confused because there's just an abundant amount of facts, and you have to start sifting. But imagine you come to a conclusion before you finished the research. That would not be wise because you may be missing a key component. So research is really the process of absorbing. Absorbing. Then comes the process of, okay, let me take it all now, and let me now process it, and come to a conclusion. Like a judge, you're standing in front of a judge and a jury. Imagine a very persuasive witness makes a case against you. And the judge and jury have been swayed. You want them to only absorb. You don't want them to process. Because maybe there's another witness. Maybe there's other evidence. The key is you need to have the deliberation. That requires absorbing before you process. Most people do not know how to do that. Nobody's been challenged to do it. I think everybody knows how to do it. You're just not forced to do it. Children are natural absorbers because they have not developed processing tools yet. That's why they hear well. They listen well. I don't mean it's hard to get a child's attention, but I mean they absorb. They're like a dry sponge. You can see it immediately. That's why you can teach a child. Imagine teaching ABC to adults like us. We wouldn't have the patience to sit 2 minutes. Why am I learning ABC? I got other things to do. And you could teach a child ABC. They have the Kabbalah cell to just sit A, B, Aleph, Kometz, Aleph, O, right? Because their minds are not yet developed tools to process. So they absorb. And they absorb. And then they become like adults and they stop absorbing. Then the sponge gets saturated. So on. So my goal would be in a class like this would be if everyone here would learn some of the skills of being able to communicate it to someone else, to teach it. You said it right. To be a passive student, even of excellent material and excellent teacher and all that, is one thing. To be a teacher yourself is a whole other thing. Now, not everybody has to become a master teacher. I'm not suggesting that. But I think as I said, you can't expect everyone to become a master teacher, but I would expect that anyone should be able to take, let's say, a concept of Gili Bligvul, Era Bligvul, Era Gvul, and show me one application that you would apply it to a situation in life. That would be my first challenge to anyone here. And not use the one I used, of course, the example. That's me speaking. That would be, trust me, you will come up with something. If you
the best one.
There's better ones. I didn't, I especially didn't use the best one. And frankly, This is not about me. This is about all of you will come up with something that will be unique to your style. That's the thing here. It's not about, not a quiz. We're not getting marking here for, it's about being, using your particular mindset and your way of thinking and taking these ideas and applying it to a situation. Just think about it. Imagine what would do it to you if you're able to do that on an ongoing basis. Trust me, your life will change. Because you'll think differently. You'll think on a much healthier way. You'll be taking ideas that are very pure and applying it to real life. You know, life is screwed up. That's the bottom line. I mean, I'm sorry to be blunt. This world is not aligned to anything that's pure. It's a selfish world that's busy with itself. Most people are dysfunctional. And it's a dysfunctional existence. The whole purpose of this is to, you know, I would say, is to take a coarse, egocentric existence and somewhat refine it to be a little edler, a little more refined, a little more mezuchach, the Russian is. And as you do it, you climb. But to do it properly is not just to understand it. It's to communicate it. And obviously to live it. But communication is already a good step toward living it. Because communication means you're able to say, this is an application. Oh, once you get into the application world, then it becomes something that is very close to then applying it to yourself. I'm not saying we still have a Yetzer Hara. Trust me. The Yetzer Hara is not going away just because you learn the Chassidus. But you have a whole different arsenal of tools at your disposal. That would be my challenge. On the contrary, I mean, you don't do this for me, by the way. This is not for yourself. That would be the way I would. I have to challenge myself the same way. When I read this, I may get it, but then when I say, okay, how would I apply it? What kind of model can you create from this in life? A model, a working model that can help people. And you'd be amazed at how many models can be created from it. Also, there's another thing which I wanted to mention, which is the inner faculties we have, your brain power and your heart power, your emotions, are far more than you think they are. Right? I mean, everyone will acknowledge that I don't know how much percentage of my abilities have been actualized. And the older you get, the more you realize that. You know, when you're younger, you could be brash and say, you know what, I'm 90% actualized. That's ridiculous, obviously. And as a compliment, it's ridiculous because you have far more than you think you have. So the question is, what is the ratio between your potential and your actual? 100 to 1? 1 million to 1? Who knows, right? Because we don't know what's in there. But it's pretty high ratio, I would say. Or pretty, a discrepant ratio. Right? Pretty big discrepancy. What I just said now is, in different words, the difference between Keiches and Levushin. So in the Alter Rebbe writes in Tanya, Keiches are your faculties, your abilities. And Levushin are your expressions. Machshav is one way, how you think. Conscious thought. What my thought right now. Dibur is how you speak. Communicate through words to others. And Maisa is how you act, or how you write, or how you actualize. So if you take Machshava, Dibra, Maisa, and make a ratio of your Machshava, Dibra, Maisa, your three ways of expression, thought, speech, action, to your abilities, very distant. So the first thing you need is to not just realize you have so much potential, but also to start refining your Machshava, Dibra, Maisa. This is called Aveda of, you know, getting your garments in order. Because that's what I said before, if you don't communicate well, and you say C before A, or you say page 3 before page 1, your Levushim are going to garble. Yes. Are you a good absorber? I was just going to use a specimen. Thing is, they're such good absorbers, they can't even talk about it. We talk about it. We talk about absorbing while we're processing. I remember once my father, Olav Shalom, so he was a brilliant guy. He was, in many ways, he could do the work of 20 people, but not more. Delegation was not his art, let's put it this way. But he was like a classic artist type. You know, very creative, energetic, but a one-man show. I remember once he used to always encourage me, wanted me to work with him. When I was working the sikhs, I wasn't going to go there. But also I said to him, Ty, what am I going to do for you? You know, give me a job description. Which itself I had to explain to him what a job description was. Now, don't get me wrong, if I was a smart man. But yeah, I mean, you know, I said, so he says, you'll do everything I do. You're my son, you can do whatever you want. So I said, everything? And what are you going to do if I do everything? He says, we'll both do everything, you know. So I said, no. There's one boss. You're the boss. Tell me what you want me to do. I'll let's stick to that, and you don't enter that area, and I won't enter your areas. Or you can train me, whatever. I know he can't answer that question, because that's what my father thought. And again, he was a brilliant man, and he could discuss it exactly as this. But in implementing it was the problem, not the concept. He conceptually he understood the whole thing. So I remember, thinking that maybe I'm going to fall in the same trap in my own life, because I'm also a creative guy, and you have these energies flowing. And I saw people who are real implementers think differently. They think much more, practically. They're not dreamers. And you need each thing. You need both, And so I was reading this book called, I think it was a Small Business Bible or something. That's what people who don't know anything about business read. Business people don't need to read books like that. They just have instinct. So I'm reading this book called the Small Business Bible. One of those. And I found an interesting statement there. It was Mamish Lakasidis. It said there that that investors, business investors, don't like to invest with creative people, with artists. But there's a reason why. Not because they're eccentric, but because their thinking is completely counter to business mind. Like here, it says there literally, an artist, once he created his art, whether his book or his art or music, whatever, his energy has already been spent. So now he's ready going to sleep. He's ready downtime because he's created. He's released it. If one person sees it and gives him a compliment, he gets his satisfaction. And the business side of it begins after it's finished. Of now, to how do you market it and how do you distribute it to the largest amount of people? And that's where the passion is. So the artist looks at the business person as a selfish person. All you care about is money, selling as many. And the artist appreciates you. You don't appreciate my gift that I've given the earth. Of my art. So he doesn't respect the second half because he sees it only as being, technical. It's like you're the copy machine. What are you going to make copies of my, like that? And I realized when I was reading it that it's the other way around. You see, the artists think that they're the selfless ones and the business people are the selfless. That it's the selfish ones. When in truth, the artist is the selfish one. He got his air expressed. And as the business person is trying to create as many kalim for it to bring it to the world. And the artist doesn't appreciate that. So I remember telling my father this. I said to my father, I told my father this, I shared this with him. I said to him, Chassidus is Eidus and Kalim. So it says the Shedish of Kalim, the root of Kalim is higher than the root of energy. Even though Eidus is giving, but Kalim receive. And Kalim is a deeper root because it's about, and I told him this thing with the investor and the creative person. So he said to me, that's excellent. It's great material for an article. You should write about it. So I said, there's no hope. It's hopeless. Forget about it. You turned even this into another Hamshacha Sa'ir. You understand? It's like the guy who says, Ein Chacham Kabal Nisayon. There's no wise person like a personal experience. He says, I read that too. So I have that experience too. I read that there's no wise person. But the experience is experience. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that that what you learn is that there are two different elements here. There's, the Alter Rebbe once said, to appreciate Chassidus, he said, it teaches you how small you are and how great you can become. So there's some people who know how great they can become. They have, grandiose dreams, illusions of grandeur, or realities of grandeur, whatever. But they don't know where they are. And then there are people who know how small they are and they don't know how great they can become. And you really need both. You need to know. You need to dream. There's no question. You need to be able to dream. If you can't dream it, you're not going to do it. But you have to also know, I'm not there yet. And that's the challenge. So I'm saying in the context of, our own actualization. So we have our levushim, which are pretty limited. So imagine you have a tremendous amount of energy inside of you, but the pipe, the channel that lets it out is narrow, narrow. That's very sad. Because it doesn't mean you don't have it. You may even get it. But you don't have a way to express it. You don't have the tools. You were not taught how, or you don't have the confidence, or whatever the reason is. And that is, I think, one of the key things in real education, teaching people, empowering them, that not only do you have the abilities, but to show how you can actualize it. And that's why I think one of the best ways to do it is to take an idea and have to present it, have to apply it to yourself, to others, where you're forced to have to express or not keep it inside. That's why I think it's so critical. Anyway, just wanted to say this divrei hesedus as we go into chapter 129. I hope it's received with the intention it was meant. I speak to myself just like I speak to you. And that's why I think that challenge is very important. You know, it's true, self-motivation is important. If you don't have no self-motivation, you're not going anywhere. But to me, the things that make me excel is deadlines, pressures, everything I hate, bottom line, you know? But the trick of the trade, for me at least, is as I force myself into situations I can't get out of. I made my commitment to learn Ayin Beis, to write summaries. I've told too many people about it. I can't now, my pride can't, it doesn't let me stop. You know, so even my ego is now invested. I mean in a good way, you know. And I think you get yourself stuck in good things, and then you're trapped, and then you have to deliver. That to me is one of the, it works for me at least, you know. And then I thought, trust me, I regret it every second. Not in a regret it in the literal way, but I mean to say, it's always easier not to have another commitment. Let's put it this way. There's a voice inside all of us that says, I have too many commitments, right? Anyway, good things. So pressure yourself. Let others pressure you. Find yourself a good friend who can kick you in the pants, who you invite them to kick you in the pants, and trust me, you'll go from good to excellence. Excellence comes with hard work. It never comes easy. People see the result, they always think, oh wow, I could just get there. No, no, no. You never see the sweat. You always see, you know, we see results, you don't see the sweat. There's a lot of sweat involved. I remember the years writing Fabringens. I can't tell you, it was, I don't want to say the word torture because it's not the appropriate word, but it was mental torture. It was unbelievably difficult. I just think back to it, but it was like the best time of my life. Because it forced me to remember Fabringens, so hard to understand. You're breaking your head to try to figure out. You have to get it on paper. There's no way around it. I was responsible to put it down. And I had to do it within 3 days. I didn't have 3 years. Thank God, 3 years I never would have done it. You know how it is. No deadline. And it was so hard, but it was unbelievable. Learning this stuff is also the same thing. If you really want to get this, you got to break your head. You got to keep going back and back and back. So the secret, my friends, is like this. We all want to get it, but you don't get it until you really break your you have to really struggle. That's the thing. You like to just get it and that's it, move on, right? No. You get it when you know that you don't get it, basically. Sorry to disappoint.
The ones, the other guys who have the same experience, the other guys who have the
Yeah, I mean, we never really spoke about it. I used to speak to Rabbi a little. He just said to me, you have to do it the way I did it, just through mistakes and learning the hard way. But for sure, there's no way. It's like, you know, writers, when they speak to each other, they know. You know, a writer knows how much you struggle. Writing is very difficult. I mean, I write easily, people think, because I can write a lot and so on. But it doesn't come easy. There's no such thing as easy writing. Sometimes you're in the zone, it's flowing, that's great. But there's no, you know, everything, an idea from its genesis and its so-called, like, from the Big Bang of a concept, to get it on paper that someone else is going to read it and resonate with them, is a production. It's not, it doesn't come easily. It doesn't come easy. I remember the first Fabringen I wrote, Shabbos Mekates Tov Shin Mem. A long time ago. What did we talk about? Nun Samachai. It's 33 years ago. Hanukkah. It's the first Fabringen I was responsible to write from beginning to end. And I remember it was a very complicated Fabringen. You know, I started out with the bang. The Rebbe Fabringen was a siyum on Shas, a siyum on Tanya. It was Yutes Kislev related. It was complicated, very complicated Fabringen. And I had to write. Now, I'm sitting down Saturday night. I remember Tzoy Shabbos by typewriter, plain old, I had a little blue typewriter. And now, and there was no word processors there. So I began typing page one. I remember it vividly. I crumpled it up in the garbage can. Another page one. I probably wrote 30 versions of page one. And I was getting very, very anxious. I remember it was like 2-3 in the morning. My father comes upstairs. And he sees me throwing these, he sees all these balls in the back, in the basket, and he starts laughing. Because I reminded him of his writing, you know. It's on the garbage can. And there, I said to him, I don't think I can do this. Took upon myself responsibility. I just can't do this. I can't get past page one. She says, you're going to have to throw a few more balls in the basket and then you'll get there. So I said, but that's page one. Then it's going to be page two. He says, no, it's going to get easier. And then I remember he told me something that till this day I'll never forget, and it's the absolute rule. He said, it's always hard to write. In 40 years from now, it's going to be hard to write. The difference between now and then is you know you can do it. It's like running a marathon. It's not easy to run a marathon, but you know you can do it. And he was right. The first page took me a few more hours, but then it went, and then I got it done. I finished the Farbrengen, one Farbrengen. And then I knew I could do it. Now, it still was hard. The next one was, trust me, it was a whole new mice, a whole new pash. And everyone was the same trepidation, always the difficulty. And it's almost, you can't, I don't know, I mean, I wish I had a teacher that literally would, I wouldn't have made a difference. I had to learn on the job. There's no way. I mean, the most someone can do is just give you confidence that you can do it. They can't do the work for you. You know, they can't do the work for you. It's impossible. But I'm just saying, applying it to myself, I think everybody here, everybody has their own challenges, and whatever it is that you have to do, there has to go. You have to go through that what they call Kur HaBarzel, you know, the melting, what do they call it, in a metal, they make metal.
The furnace.
You have to go through a furnace. It's good to have people who've done it, because they give you, they show you, you can do it because I've done it, you know, that type of thing. Then I remember I used to speak to Rabbi El a lot, because he was from the early, you know, he was like the pioneer. He was the first Chazer. He told me the first years, he didn't know what he was doing. He said the Rebbe would write most critical. He says it was so demoralizing to him. And the Rebbe would like say, you know, how could you even give me, it's not worth the paper it's written on, type of thing. Then you learn, you keep fighting, and you keep getting better and better and better. I remember some guys, I was training them when we were working in Sichas. After 3-4 weeks, they said, this is not for me. My ego is far too fragile for this stuff. This is too bruising. I remember guys, good guys, scholars. One guy just reminded me, he's a shliach, California. He said to me, I remember I worked like a month or two. It was too brutal. Because others look it over, and they say, this is completely wrong. You know, and you're not going to get the... And he was one of the top geniuses in yeshiva. In yeshiva, he was top, but now he was dealing with the big leagues. And it's a whole new level. And he couldn't handle it wasn't personal attacks. Couldn't handle the brutal mental challenges. I remember it was very tough. You had to have very tough skin. The Rebbe was very, very sharp and wrote very sharp. His editing was unbelievably brutal. Not, God forbid, in any negative way. It was the precision of a pure mind. I remember the Rebbe would write... He had this word called mavhil. Mavhil means shocking. So if you wrote something that was a little off, and remember the Rebbe's shocking, and you're not shocking, are not the same level. The Rebbe's shocking was like if you missed a Gemara somewhere, that, you know, you say this, how would anyone know there's such a Gemara? By the Rebbe, that was shocking. How could you miss a Beferish Gemara? You know what I mean? So I remember the Rebbe would write mavhil, and sometimes he'd underline it once, twice, three times. We were even Zeche 7 times underlined. It doesn't end there. Then add a few, a question mark and exclamation point. Then add a few question marks and exclamation points. Imagine a mavil, 7 times underlined, with 6 exclamation points and 6 question marks, interspersed. You know, so you could study how many levels of shock is that.
You have them? Okay.
Yeah, I have them. Pretty good, huh?
Huh? Did you save with them?
Of course, these were the best. Yeah. I never took that personal at all. I learned from it. So it was rarely a shock that was like a stupid mistake. It was always depth. I'll give you one example. You tell me the Rebbe was shocking that we didn't realize this. But you see, the Rebbe's shock, on the contrary, taught me that he's expecting us to be able to get such a thing, which made the standard higher. On the contrary, I Rebbe didn't like something we wrote, but I loved to hear this because it was telling me, you want excellence? This is excellence. That what you're writing is not. There were the few times we had typos and stuff, but I mean the real, I'll give you an example. The Rebbe brought the story, you know, the classic story of Nachum Chernobler. Well, the bottom line is, when something is really important for you to do, the Yetzirah often, that's where it challenges. So the thing you hate most should be the thing you're doing. Of course, other times, the other way around. But there's the classic story about that. If there's a lot of resistance, it means that's the right thing to do. So the Rebbe brought the story, and then he wrote on the side, when we presented it, the Rebbe wrote, I think, Mavil, or something like that. It wasn't with many question marks, but it was shocking that you didn't realize it's a Beferish Maimer Chazal. That's a specific Maimer Chazal. Now, remember, Everyone who told the story since the Alter Rebbe's times, no one ever wrote this Maamar Chazal. The Rebbe is saying to us, why didn't we realize it's a Maamar Chazal? That was the Rebbe's time. What was the Maamar Chazal? The Rebbe wrote it. He wrote, Oyev Hasein Hasein Kedem. It's halacha. That if you have two people you can help, and one person is your friend, and one person is your enemy, you should help your enemy first.
And in the Sefer the Rebbe said, he quoted the...
No. He told the story. That when something, you resist something, you should do it. But the Rebbe, the Maamar Chazal, is a halacha. The halacha is that you should help your enemy before your friend. It has nothing to do with resistance. But when you think about the logic of the halacha, it's the same logic. And by the Rebbe, that was shocking. We didn't make this connection.
It goes against what you're supposed to get tzedakah to.
So the Rebbe was like, would you actually add in your own...
or suggest it, you know. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, no, the Rebbe's expectations are very high. Thank God. He challenged. Paul, the Rebbe was very challenging.
You're supposed to give tzedakah, for example, to your family.
I know this. I know there's sometimes it's. I said it sometimes says the other way around. Yeah.
But
so you have a mashpir. You look at situations. I always say to myself when I resist ice cream, it means that's what I should be eating. That's how I apply. Everyone tells me you can't have that. And I say that means that God wants me to have it because everyone says that's a joke. That situation is the other way around. It's another resistance. Anyway, so we're up to the challenge. Good.
I'm just curious about, and Bilti Muga is, that's...
Bilti Muga is when we wrote it and the Rebbe did not edit it. So we wrote from our memory, we researched it, we prepared it as best as possible, and then we printed it. So technically the Rebbe did not give his final... It's pretty good also, the Bilti Muga, trust me.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, but it doesn't have that formal stempel. It's also from the Friedrich Rebbe Rashab, Bilti Muga, Sichus and so on.
If they weren't Muga, were they like gone over a few extra times? Or anything, or just ended up that they weren't Muga?
No. They were gone over a few extra times. Most were not Muga. Later in the years, the Rebbe started editing more. But most were not. What we do, when not Muga, we would take less risks, obviously. In the Muga, you're sending it to the Rebbe so you can be more explicit.
You knew when you were preparing it, if this is going to be a Muga.
In many cases, sometimes not. Sometimes the Rebbe would edit a built-in Muga thing. He would actually take the printed and actually edit it. Sometimes the Rebbe would ask for something. I mean, in the years you knew, for example, when the Rebbe spoke the Heirah to learn Rambam. So we knew he was going to be Magia that, because it was a Heirah, you know, the Tav Shem Amdal, the Rebbe came out to learn Rambam daily. So we knew that was a Pesach Sikha. So I prepared that because I knew the Rebbe was going to edit that. He would edit things like that. Anything that was a global Hira or something special. But there was sometimes a Rashi Sikha, which we didn't understand clearly. We would ask questions. The Rebbe would answer. And we would then, questions we always asked, even on Bilti Muga. The Rebbe would answer. Once he answered, we would sometimes prepare that and send it into the Rebbe, and the Rebbe would edit that section. So if you look in the Hanukkah, you'll see it doesn't say Bilti Muga on that page. That means that the Rebbe was Magiyat, even though the whole version is still Bilti Muga, but a few pages were Muga. We usually write Mikan from Sif Aleph to Sif Gimel is Muga. You'll see that often. Because the Rebbe would sometimes edit just sections.
How long would it take the Rebbe, you know?
A full Sikha? I would say 3-4 hours sometimes. We don't know exactly because no one was inside the room. We know from times when we gave in a Sikha, let's say 11 o'clock, later years, and the Rebbe was in his room. And we'd see that the Sikha would come at 3 o'clock and then the lights would go off. So you knew that probably he was working in the last few hours. But was he working every minute? You know, you could tell. You could also tell. No, we're talking about 2 o'clock in the morning. There's no one there. But you can tell because the Rebbe would edit in one shot usually. I mean, there were times he held the Sikha. There was you can't really know exactly. Sometimes you could see from the edits that it took time. The person wrote, you know, sometimes it was a quicker edit. There's no real rules. It was fascinating. I mean, it's a whole study of how the Rebbe edited. I learned precision from the Rebbe. Like, you know, by me, a word is like a child. Every letter, how you express yourself, because the Rebbe's precision was unbelievable. Not only that, he taught also. I learned from the Rebbe how the power of nuance and above all the power of intentional ambiguity. That he does not want it to be spelled out. He wants it to be allowed to be interpreted several ways. That is an art. Not everyone thinks you have to spell everything out. No, I can tell you, show your sikhs, the Rebbe intentionally took it and made it less clear. At least you think it's less clear because he wanted several interpretations. Which you could also apply to Yoni Mashiach, just for the record. So, intentionally, the Rebbe did not want to spell certain things out and wanted left for interpretation. There's nothing wrong with that when you're in a good a good book, good piece of literature always has that. There's certain things that are very, very sharp and clear, and some things are left for your imagination or interpretation. Many times it was. I remember the Rebbe wrote once to me. He wrote on the side. He wrote, "We don't see this is not what he put it. He says it's not carpentry, where you have to have a nail in every hole. You know, in other words, it's not you got to have it all like an equation that's figured out from every side. We're not here to say mamala kalam is this and never anything else. It's not that way. There's a far more. It's a broader thing. It's like the thing we all as kids hate when the teachers would tell us. So what's we find a contradiction? So they would say zvenzel v'meret." You know that one, right? They would say, depends where you're talking. Talking in this context, it's like this. And this context, like that. When you're younger, you're really disturbed by these type of relativity statements. You want to tell me, is this or that? What are you talking about? It's black or white. But you, as you get older, you realize nuance and the gray area is far more complicated. So let's learn Kochav Tes. Amnam Adayin Tzarech Lohavin V'Aloi Ha'er Panimi. However, we still have to understand that isn't the inner, imminent inner energy, the internal energy, who gamkin lohayra el mislias behem pchinas habitl. Also, Er Pnimi, why are you saying that the Er Makif, the Er Abligvul, is there in order to transform existence? What was the word I before? To shape existence and to elevate existence. Also, the Er Pnimi, isn't it? It's also lohayra el mislias behem pchinas habitl. So, when God uses his paintbrush, the 10 spheres, to create existence, yes, there's an element of it, of shaping existence. But it's a divine hand that's shaping it. So the Er HaMamala, the energy that's within a plant, within a tree, within daimon, mineral, vegetable, animal, human being, is also Liyaz Behem B'chinas HaBitl. It's also to bring Bitl. Which is, of course, the question. So why are you saying that only the Er Gili mina etzem, only the energy that's not shaping existence brings bitl. Like it says, the pardes. This is the Ramak, the fourth gate, chapter 5. The pirish maimer hatikun ezer, in the explanation of the tikun ezer, antu dafikat. You are the one that produces dafikat, that emerges dafikat, that generates. Talks about the spheres. Lanhoge behun alman, to control lanhage, to govern the world. Manig, to govern, to direct, to
conduct,
to govern the world. Lanhoge, the manig, like the captain of the ship, to run the world. Liyus ayodam gili elikus beilus. Liyus ayode gili elikus beilus. In order for there to be gili elikus. So in other words, we see from here that the spheres, which means the Er Pnimi, not the Er Makif, is in order to bring, is to run the world and in order to bring godliness into them. Well, Kumoishin is Barley El Perik Ches, or Perik Memches, like we learned earlier, chapter 8 and chapter 48, the Amtsoyis Hatzilis Ubebez Dvarim. What is the role of the interface of Hatzilis? It's in two things. Ha'echot Shiyeh Dezei Savas Elmas. Yeah. The first is to bring into existence the created worlds of Bri Yitzirasiyah B'Bchinas Hametziyah Shelahem in a form of substance. Shezeu Ikra Ideya Kelim. That's primarily through the containers. Like he says, the Alter Rebbe writes in the Geras HaKedesh, Simachof. This was written by the Alter Rebbe a short period before his passing, like the Tzemach Tzedek writes, Simachof. So what does he say? That he and his containers are one in order to create. So let's explain what this means. We learned earlier that Atzilus has two roles. One is, it's an interface to create. So let's use an example. You know, the original code in computers was zero ones. That's the purest form. But most of us, and most people cannot. If you know, you had to sit down before you type an A, you need to type the zero ones to make an A, forget about it. It won't be efficient. So then the next layer of code was written. You know, the first codes that were written were really basically organizing the zeros and ones into simpler formulas that in turn would become algorithms, etc. Then the next level of code was created. You know, to the point, code after code, that you've got many of these interfaces to today, you can sit by a computer and you type in, let's say, you know, you type a search in Google, a word, and all the work is being done for you behind the scenes, all the programming, all the way down to the zeros and ones. But anyone who understands the process knows when you're typing an A, you're not shaping and carving an A out of a rock. It's a digital, you're pressing a button that's generating electrical impulse that's doing whatever has to done, and it generates a whole series of code that's taking place. So why am I saying this? I'm just using an example how something from a pure energy level becomes a substance, and then you can print out a page and you have yourself a product. So in the process of the cosmic order, how God creates, it's the same thing. Everything begins in a very pure energy level. You could say zeros and ones. Igulim and Yesha. A zero is an igul and Yesha is a line. And then it starts developing so-called new layers until we have an existence like our own. So any formation of anything so-called from nothing to something is a process. Atzilus is a key interface, because it's the place where basically energy meets matter. Essentially, you could put it that way. Now, when I say matter, I don't mean necessarily physical matter, but matter in the context of identity, where energy, more abstract energy, meets identity. So Eris and Kalim come together, but they are divine, Eris and Kalim. So the divine manifesting in a code called Esesphiris that are now going to shape existence. If you took away Atzilus from the picture, it would be like trying to get energy that is not shaped into bottled into a structure. It wouldn't work, again, with our logical system. So Atzilus becomes the interface where, let's say, the Esher Sfiris, which are the Aseres HaDibris, become the Asar HaMamoris, Yihi Oyer. So God utters Yihi Oyer, those words, Yihi Oyer, Aleph Vav Resh. Aleph Vav Resh is like the touching, is like a certain code that generates a whole thing from energy and translating into Oyer, light, which will ultimately become physical light when you put on enough garments. So Atzilus is that place where the energy meets the definition called Eir. In Lifnei Atzilus, Eir would be either Machshava or Eir is a concept, but at some point God says Yihi Eir. And now that creates Biyah. In Biyah, Eir becomes now substantial. You keep adding layers to it until you add the final physical layer. That's what he says. So Elokus, using the Kalim, primarily the Kalim of Atzilus, creates the shaped existence that we have. So that's role number one in Atzilus, is the creation of existence. Now comes number two. Rabbeis, Shaydei Atzilus Davki Yochel is Gila Lekuz Be'elam. The second thing we learned in chapter 8 and chapter 48 is through Atzilus you could have Gila Lekuz Be'elam. Because what I just said was the creation of existence. This doesn't mean that the code that brought this existence into being, that the existence can relate to the code. We can just say we're here, but we have no idea how to get back, so to speak. We can't trace our steps back. So there's another thing. Atzilus also opens up a pathway that you can get back to your creator, so to speak. You can find the source, code. So it's two things, two tracks. One is an energy that creates, brings it into being, and an energy that you can also reveal. It reveals itself in this existence. Okay? I'm trying to find an example of... So that's the second role. Yoshkali is Gili Elikus. Vuhu Inyan. What is this? What means Gili Elikus? What does it mean Gili Elikus? He says, Yedias Vasogus Elikus Vaharigishus Elikus Sheba Elam. This means the understanding of, the contemplation and comprehension of the divine, and a gishus, and a divine sensation, feeling, in this world. Let's spell that out. In simple English, it means every one of us, unless something is distorting it, has a sense that there's something more than our reality. You have like a sense of, we're calling it divine. Some people don't like the word divine, they call it nature. They call it higher reality. But there's a sense, both in mind and in feeling, of something that is not of this earth. Some transcendental cognitive awareness and emotional awareness. That's what he's saying here. Does this be accurate? Because some people always ask me when we read things like this, I know some people that just don't have any of that. And I would say that's not true. Everybody has it. They just translate it differently. Some people translate it through romance, some through music, some through art, some through decadent things even. But it's not just the pure routine and the what do I want to say, the mechanisms of life, mechanics of life. Everybody has a sense and is searching for something beyond. How they search for it, I'm not getting out whether it's holy, not holy. But to say that we're just animal bliss of a type of complete survival, nobody lives like that. Everybody has a sense of something. So where does it come from? If we are creatures that were just created, we have that sense, means that you have something implanted in this existence that is what he calls Gilui Elokus. Now the interesting thing is, you could say animals have this too. For example, but when the tsunamis come, when natural disasters, people look toward animals, because animals have a sense earlier than we do that something's happening. So you can say they have this deep senses. So number one is, my answer would be, it's true. They're also created by God, and God did not necessarily deprive them of any awareness. You know, they say dogs, for example, someone mentioned, have sometimes instincts, really like a fifth instinct when a person is needy of something. They'll come and, like, so-called show a certain love. I mean, I never had a dog, I don't know this, but I've heard from people. And I'm not surprised. I mean, God did create creatures with sensitivity, and different creatures have different sensitivity. This doesn't mean they have free will. It just means that they have. So that doesn't, so it shouldn't disturb us that animals have that sense.
They did experiments even on plants.
All right.
Plants can recognize their caretakers, so to speak, even when they're...
Do they? They really do?
They really? Actually did it with shrimp and plants. They did something.
I heard that the book about that Japanese researcher with the crystals of water. Yeah. You know, in What the Bleep Do We Know? You familiar with that film? That he actually shows in his experiments that if there's a very angry environment, people are upset, the water crystals will turn into grotesque shapes. And a good environment where there's like an ambiance that's warm and loving, they will shape into beautiful image. I never replicated it, and I'm sure there's people who are detractors, but that's...
What is Torah and Chesed?
No, I have no... From a point of view, because there's no question about it. It's energy. And even physics, it shouldn't be a problem. Because moods give off energy, and energy affects things. That's not the end of the world. There was a film a few years ago called What the Bleep Do We Know? It's online, you can probably find it. I saw it. It was very interesting. It was exactly that. It was how Trach gut vid sein gut, basically. That the line they used there was excellent. They said, how your neurons are fired, that's how they get wired. So in other words, the way you think actually wires your attitudes, shape your mind's way of dealing with things. If you consistently are negative about something, your mind becomes a negatively wired mind. Not just an attitude, it's actually begashmis. It makes total sense. Because there's no question, I mean, when we are moods, today we know is serotonin, and we have chemicals that are running through our bodies.
Like 3/4 water.
No, so there's no question that you know, sometimes people take a drug that creates a better mood, so why can't you naturally produce a certain, what do they call it? What's the serotonin, but the thing that pleases, the thing that you feel when you're pleased.
Endorphins.
Yeah, one of these, I'll tell you an example of myself. When I was a kid, I remember I went to a camp in Detroit, and I was sensitive those years to allergies, to hay fever, ragweed. But in Detroit, for some reason, there was overabundance of it. I should sue Beryl Shemta for that, but that's another story.
Mm-hmm. It was going to make the class, actually. We didn't have enough. There was
Mashke over there. Whatever. But anyway, I had this attack, an allergy attack. I remember it was in camp in Oak Park, wherever it was. I forgot where it was. Flint, Michigan. And I literally couldn't breathe. So it was like almost an asthmatic attack. So they gave me something that like opened up my passages. And it was just a test. And then when I came home, I went to an allergist. His name was Dr. Redner. He was a very famous allergist. You know, so he gave me these scratch tests. And the two that really blew up were dust and ragweed. But they really blew up. It was like a serious reaction. And I had a reaction right there in his office. And I was like, you know, real serious allergic reaction. So he gave me a shot, took it all away. Now, I don't know if you ever suffer allergies. It's not dangerous, but it's definitely, it's a pain in the butt, basically. Like, basically, the most beautiful summer days where everybody's enjoying, you're your nose doesn't stop running, the tickle in your throat can drive you crazy. You know, the whole thing. I don't know if you've ever had allergies. And when the Rebbe would blow shofar, remember, allergy season was mid-August through September. So Rosh Hashanah was right smack in the middle. So all the allergy guys, before the Rebbe came out to blow shofar, were in the bathroom collecting toilet paper. You know, for the... Yeah, so we all knew who were... And I could tell you all the guys in 770 that had allergies.
Well, because of the dust that came out of the
shofar? No. Because the season, you were standing by a shofar and you have no tissues. We would go make... We'd go refill for tissues before the big show, basically. You can't get out. Once you're in the thing, the washing machine, as they call it, you couldn't get out. So you needed to reload on your tissues. I'm just giving you some trivia of the good old days. But listen to this. He gave me this shot, and suddenly this... And for me, it was like a miracle. Everything cleared up. I felt beautiful. I could breathe. Clear. I said, what was that? So he said, it's adrenaline. Give me a shot of adrenaline. So I said, the adrenaline that we talk about, that you generate? He said, yeah. So I said, so what do you give me all these tests? And you tell me I have to take shots now for 4 years till I get immune. Just give me this adrenaline. I'll just take it. He says, no, you'll build up immunity and it could be dangerous. Adrenaline is not good to be on adrenaline all the time. So I asked him a question then, which I realized. I said, you know, when I write Fibrinogens, on Sundays I never suffer allergies. So I used to always think, the reason is I'm so busy, I don't notice my nose is running. Is it possible that adrenaline kicks in and it's causing, natural adrenaline is causing the allergies to go down? He said, absolutely. He says, why do you think, this is what he told me, why do you think concert pianists, actors in a Broadway play, opera singers, for 3-4 hours, you're not going to see them yawn or sneeze. How do they control that? Yawn and sneeze, or yawn maybe, but sneeze, he says, is not controllable. Sneeze, something gets in your way, your nose will sneeze. You can't stop a sneeze. He says, when you're on adrenaline, you have a certain superhuman control over regular faculties, and you can't fake it. Either you're on it or you're not on adrenaline. So I realized from that, I said, wow, 1 second. So you're telling me that if we could get people excited about their lives, and adrenaline get flowing naturally.
There's no more sneezing in the world.
Besides no sneezing, there'll be a lot of other problems resolved. And he said, I remember, I thought about it, I asked him, he said, hypothetically, yeah. And I could tell you, from my own life, adrenaline is my major, I don't need caffeine, definitely don't need other stuff. I'm not a caffeine guy, nothing like that. It's adrenaline that gets me going. And there's no question, it's an immunizer against many things. I'm talking about physical. No doubt in my mind. Think about it. Think a person who's like, let's say, you know, down. I would say that the human natural, the common cold is God's gift to mankind to give them excuse not to be productive. Because you could say, I'm under the weather, I'm over the weather, I'm almost under the weather, I'm coming out from under, you know, a lot of people. So you have a few weeks you can say, okay, listen, I was down. So it's a good, imagine there were no colds, no excuses, no sleep. 24/7 you have to be awake with yourself and figure out what you're doing with your life. It would be pretty... Suicide rate would go up.
After a while.
Huh?
If you did it constantly, your adrenals would get weak and you'd get the opposite problem.
I understand. I'm talking about that. But no, if you're excited about your life...
Fine, but people that are under a lot of stress, they get hypoadrenia.
No, not just stress. We're talking about angst. The Alter Rebbe was looking for the love of Malchus Datsilis. Kept him going. I have no doubt that the Rebbe's health and ability to, I'm talking now, I don't know, Ruchnis, but at least Ruchnis and Gashmis, a lot of it was a drive that just overrode any type of pain or any type of physical impediments.
Stroke came from hypoadrenia.
Okay. Yeah, but the Rebbe was 90, he was 92.
I understand.
Okay. Well, what, not 90, that was it. 90. Anyway, so the second thing Atzilus does is create a gilui. Now, it's interesting our free association flow here. Are we getting, you know, all the 9 bays? I use this for my own psychotherapy. I'm just my group and audience.
A guy in prison.
Group therapy.
This is not scientifically proven, but I met a guy in scientifically proven. I met a guy in prison and he refuses to eat any of the prison food and this.
What time
so,
is
it? 10:35.
10:35.
He doesn't let any other person's energy go into his food or anything. He just has raw vegetables. He gets it himself.
It reminds me of that guy that the Rebbe spoke about. What was his name? The wealthy guy that died out of the recluse because he was afraid of bacteria and everything. What was his name?
Howard Hughes.
Howard Hughes.
Yeah.
The Rebbe spoke about him.
Yeah. billionaire.
Yud Aleph Nissen, Tavshin Lamed Vav, the Rebbe spoke about it. He says, a man worth all the billions of dollars, and look, he's the biggest prison of all. Yeah, seriously paranoid.
Yeah, this guy is scared of bad vibes and his food.
Okay.
And where is he in prison?
He's in prison. Raw vegetables.
So the second thing is Atzilus is a pipe that opens up a Vigilia Lakus, Ba'elam. It's very efficient of God. He didn't create two different pipes, one to create and one to reveal. It's the same pipe that creates, reveals.
These two are.
That's a good lesson for technology, you know. Same pipe.
Two in one mechanism. Is that correct?
It says that here.
In other words, the Kli,
the Kalim of Atzilus, which shape. Yeah.
Very efficient.
Yeah. Well, in the human body, by the way, you find this too. You find organs that have more than one function.
Sure.
I mean, they may have different components, but it's in, as far as space goes, it's a pretty efficient machine.
Of course.
So.
And the brain directs the creation of the body, and also that's part of the
right. Yeah.
The lungs, they take in and they bring out air.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Good. And the heart contracts and expands. Yeah. But thank God they're not one organ doing everything. We have at least some diversity.
Lots of show.
Because if that would happen, something breaks down, we're in big trouble. Yeah. This way, one thing breaks down, at least only one or two functions. It's not a whole machine. You can. this is a lesson in engineering. Good to think about. Who in yediyas? Okay, so this is yediyas v'asogas alakus v'argishus. I was talking about the sensations, the cognitive and emotional sensations of alakus. Shekol zem ha'esesfiris datzilus mepchinis meichin umidus. All this comes from the 10 spheres of Atzilus, the mind and emotions of Atzilus. Shuzel wa'ikim min ha'er, and this is primarily from the air. So the kelim of Atzilus primarily are what we call the instruments of creation. And the Eiris of Atzilus, which are in the Kalim, are primarily the Gili, Elikus. Now we learned this before. This doesn't mean the Kalim don't reveal at all. But relatively speaking, Eiris are far more a revelation than Kalim. Okay. Like it says in Siddur. This is the Siddur that's called usually the Mittler Rebbe Siddur. It's really the Siddur of the Alter. Is the Mittler Rebbe composed Siddur, taking my Maimon from the Alter Rebbe commentaries on davening? You may call it Siddur Imdach. That's it. Tfilas Mekol Hashon, Siddur Imdach. Well, it's not the Siddur itself the Alter Rebbe composed, but the Biyurim Echsiddis are my Maimon of the Alter Rebbe, written by the Mittler Rebbe, and he prepared it to make. It's a Siddur Al Pich Siddis, basically. Like the Alter Rebbe didn't say Maimorim on the Siddur. He said Maimorim, and he took ideas from those Maimorim that were ever an explanation of a Pirushat Amilas. So in Siddur Shara Krishma, he says, to guver nefesh the malachim shoin chemer v'tzur zeh b'chinas ezer v'kelam datzilus. Okay, malachim, angels, are not white-winged elves. We've established that, right? Angels are basically energies. They're just called malachim, because on the level of Bria, they're not just Eir, they actually begin to have an identity. So that's what he's saying. So Malach, like Michal, is Chesed. Malach Gavriel is Gvura. Malach Raphael is Teferis. Though the three Malachim came to Avram Avinu, each one had their mission. So they're essentially emissaries, but they're agents, divine agents. So it says there that they have that there's a guver nefesh, they have a body and a spirit. That's chemer and surah. Chemer is like the substance, surah is the usually shape, but here it means spirit. Chemer and surah would mean chemer is like the raw piece of clay, and surah is the form and function essentially. Zem b'chinas eris v'kelem d'atzilus. That form and function, that chemer and surah, comes from eris v'kelem d'atzilus.
In other words, like in Atzilus, it's all.
He means Ruchnis Dikachem and Surah here, not Gashmistik.
Well, and Bria is not Ruchnis
Dikachem and Surah? Yeah, I'm saying, in Elam Abriya, that's what he's talking about here. In Atzilus, you can't call it Guf Nefesh. You call it Eren Keli. It's an energy in a container. Think of it that way. Remember the codes I mentioned? When you see an A B, you're already seeing real containers and energies. If it's in the code level, it's still, it's called Eren Keli. In Bria, it would be called a Mal. There's Eris and Kalim in Bria also. But then there's also creations, creatures called Malachim. They're made up of basically body and soul, but not like a physical body and soul. The fact they manifest physically is a different story. They're also made up of two. So he says, so it comes from Eris and Kalim. The Zesh Yezbem Chinus Abitl Elikus. This, that these angels have a Bitl Telikus, because they're subjugated. Vegam Yezbem Tzad Purit Mitzad Achemer. And this is, and my tone was wrong. This Eris and Kelim Chemet Surah is, one side is the bitl they have to Lakus, that's the Surah, the Nefesh. And they have another side, Vegam Yeshbem Tzad Pirud Mitzad Chemet. They also have an element that separates them from the divine. So you can't call them one with godliness, they're agents of God. But they're not, like Eris and Kelim Atzilus say, Iyu v'chayu ichad, Iyu v'gamuya. He is one with his energies, one with his containers. A malach is a loyal servant, but he's a servant. So there's an element of separation, there's an element of attachment. So he's saying from Siddur, we see from this, that a keli, chaymer creates the separation, and Eir creates the bittel. Basically he's trying to say, and then he goes, and the same is also is even in the creatures below. They have a comprehension, divine comprehension, and divine bitl, a certain sense of subjugation, sublimation to the divine. He's simply saying that the Atzilus has two real roles. One is the kelim, through the kelim creation, and through the air there's more bitl. That's what he's basically saying. All this is not from the divine infinite energy. This is all part of the question. These are all the energies and containers of the 10 spheres of Atzilus. So this is the case, that also Erez V'Kelim, which means the defined energy, the focused and targeted energy of Atzilus, also creates Bittul. So what is it that we said earlier? This Erez Ein Sof, that is the revelation of the core source, because its purpose is to create bittul. We see even Eir Pnimi, Eir Mamala, the imminent energy in existence also creates bittul. So what is this uniqueness about the infinite energy? Now obviously we can assume the answer, but it's a higher level of bittul. But he's going to explain it. So that's the question on the table here.
Chomer and Surah by the Malachim proves that there's both elements of Gila and
Mitzius and Pirud. Yeah.
And just one more, can you give me another example?
I think, you see, the challenge here is we think either physically, I mean, the physical world, that's why I use the word example with the codes. So I wanted to show an example of something that has many, many layers. It's not just zeros and ones and you jump to you know, user-friendly. There are many interfaces. Like what Microsoft's main thing when they created Windows was basically they created GUI. It was DOS, DOS, right? It was an operating system. So basically, they made an easy, user-friendly interface, which behind the scenes, when you were pressing a button, was generating things that once upon a time you'd need a programmer to do for you. That's why I'm using these examples, because it just shows you there's many layers. So we understand Chomer and Surah in the simplest sense of the word would be the letters on this page is Chomer. The idea that the letters convey is Surah. That's everything has that. Energy container. I just said words. If I garbled my words, it would just be meaningless. I said words. You're hearing the idea in the words. But on the other hand, if I didn't have words, you wouldn't know what I'm thinking. So everything in this world you can define as, you know, sometimes they call it form and function. You go to a designer. You know, I learned this because I work with designers. So a designer says, tell me what your function is. What do you want to achieve? And then I'll create a form around it. Many people make the mistake. They go to a designer and say, create something beautiful. The first thing they want to do is know what you want. What's your soul? Tell me the soul of your organization. I mean, everyone knows this. This is, they use the word soul, actually. Even though they don't mean it in a divine way. The soul, what's your mission? What do you want to achieve? And then, you want people to drink your Kool-Aid. So I have to create a certain enticing image that will convey that. So form follows function, as they say. You know, Even when it comes to automobiles, the design of automobiles, they want to convey sleekness, cool, efficient, powerful. You know. So the point that I'm trying to say, everything has a chemer. Chemer is the outer. Sometimes chemer, sort of the simplest example given is, let's say, a potter. You take a raw piece of clay, and then you put it on, what do they call it, an anvil? When they, you know, when they shape a pottery, not anvil.
No, potter's wheel.
A potter's wheel. So you take this clay, it's raw, and a good sculptor will take it and shape it into a beautiful, or take raw, or melt gold down and then shape it. This is chemer tzura in a different way. Tzura being more like the
end result.
The end result, or the shape of it, and chemer being the raw material. But it's the same idea if you think about it. You know, one is more keli, one is more air. So when you go up the levels, in Atzilus it's pure Eris and Kelim. In Bria, the Eris and Kelim also have Malachim. And Malachim also have the Chemer. Would be, let's say, you know, why couldn't the Malachim do the same job? Every Malach has Ishlichus. Because a Malach can't do two jobs because of his Chemer. If he was completely bottled to Lakus, he would just be able to do anything you tell me to do. You know, as a matter of fact, the Malach is not like a pipe that goes both ways. He does only one function and then that's it. But a malach has an element of chemer that defines his role. Is, let's say, this malach was coming to tell Sarah she's going to have a son, right? Another malach is coming to destroy his daim, you know, the different tafkidim. That's like, and then there's the element that they're dedicated. They're messengers. They're equal messengers of God, so like for different functions. Bottom line, as you can say, is the higher you go in Ishtalshalus, the more bittel there is, because everything is more air and less keli. Wherever there's more chemer, you can rest assured it's moving away from its source. That's why it's so defined by substance. Now God wants tachtenim. He wants a world that's very shaped and individualistic, fragmented to the point, from point of fragmentation, to come and reconnect. But Eir and Keli is really the words used. Eir is always a connector. Keli is more of a shaper of identity. That's essentially.
Isn't there something very chemerdic about Surah?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, especially when you talk about the pot. I mean, it's this shape, it's not that shape. So it's like the shape itself as opposed to any other.
Well, you're touching a very interesting point. Chacha Fagan was the Friedrich Rebbe secretary, but was a Bismarck. He writes about it in Hatomim, about Surah and Chemer. See, Surah and Chemer can be interpreted in several different ways. If you talk about Surah as the purpose of the object, then it's much more sublime. If you talk about Surah as being like the beauty of the object, then you're right, it could be far more, even more grub in a way. Like sometimes when you say a student, we'd rather you remain a chaymer golem, more like unshaped before, because too much shape becomes a contradiction. So in that sense you're right, but I think here we're not talking, we're talking here at Surah more in sublimity, in other words, the purpose of the object, which is far more refined than the object itself. Like here, I take letters, Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dal, and I can just scatter them, or I can make a tzura of them and convey a beautiful, like, eloquent idea. So it's just the uses of the term. So let's put it this way.
But
sometimes chaymer is seen as a higher level and tzura is a lower level. Here I would say the other way around. Because you're saying like chaymer would be like God created the seed and then shaped it into existence, so it's far more broken down. In that sense, you're right. But here he's talking the other way. It's Surah as in purpose, the divine purpose of it, the deeper purpose, the soul of it. Think of Surah as soul more. That's how, it's just two different ways you describe it. In a way, they're connected, because the way God wanted, he didn't want everything in a seed. He wanted a nucleus. He wanted it to be developed, because that's the real purpose of existence, is expressed when there's the details. Let's not confuse matters. For all practical purposes, Tzura is more like Oyer here, and Chemer is more like Keli, in that sense. In the Shtalshus, it goes like, yeah, the Kelim begin more of a unshaped, and then the Oyer shapes them into more details. But that's not, yeah, okay. The answer to this is that this itself, that we just said, that the immanent energy radiates in all the worlds, and also in the lower worlds of Bria, Yetzirah, Asiyah, v'yibchinus habitl, and that they should have bitl, zehu al yedei er shebchinus ein sef. Who infuses the immanent energy that pipe that's bringing bittul into existence, in the shape of existence, that itself is coming from the Eir Ein Sof. That's what he's saying here.
The Eir Ein Sof
is a reflection of the source. Now, I don't want to guess what he's going to say, but the logic is beautiful if you think about it, because as I said before, a system cannot change itself. So the beauty here is that God is allowing the Eir Ein Sof to enter into the pipe that shapes existence, but it's not that the pipe has it on its own. It that itself, the fact that it can bring bittul and not just create, not just shape existence, it could also elevate it, is because it's connected to the energy that's beyond. That's the.
But there's obviously.
It's something like this. It's like, think of it like this. I just visualized it. Think of a pipe actually that's bringing water into your home. Now this pipe has gotten rusty, and now there's rust in the water. What do you do? So you can have a filter on the receiving end. But another thing you can do is rush water from the source. That a surge of clean water that just cleans it out and will bring you back clean water, because it'll clean out the rust. So in other words, as long as the pipe is connected to its source, which means in this case Eir Ein Sof, Eir HaBligvul can always be accessed and essentially inform and affect the imminent energy to bring the bittul that it has to bring into existence. That was just my little visual.
I was just wondering that but when it talks about Armakis, it's talking about we have a direct connection to Armakis, not through Arpnimi. And this answer is...
Right now, you're right, but he's not going there right now. He's not there yet. That's got another discussion. That's another level. Right now, he's talking in the way they meet, where the two meet. Yeah, but let's see where he's going to go here. But what you were saying is correct, and I was going to address it because there's elements where Makiv directly impacts us, not through Eir Pnimi. That's usually things like Mesiras Nefesh, Yom Kippur, with his particular unique situations where you just jolted into another place because Eir Makiv leads you, gets you out of trouble. But it's not necessarily using Eir Pnimi. I mean, everything goes through Eir Pnimi, but it could be bypassing the Eir Pnimi switches, so to speak. You do have elements of that in life. But that's not what he's addressing now. Right now he's addressing it more, so Pnimi creates bittul, he's saying that bittul itself comes from the power of the Bli Gvul. Because according to the Maimer Kav Hamida, Maimer Kav Hamida means according to the utterance, to basically to the tailored, focused, targeted energy that's in the Kav Hamida. Kav Hamida is a measuring tool, a measuring instrument. So the amount of ink that's going into your pen, according to that, shenimded betchilas hayishtalshus, that was measured in the beginning of the cosmic order. Ein eir atzilus meir klal bebiya. If you're going to use the paintbrush that creates existence, the paintbrush diminishes the energy, and the energy of atzilus doesn't enter biya. So how could this water that's coming through a very narrow pipe bring in bittul? It's bringing existence, and what's in atzilus doesn't come into biya. Everything is. The flow is flow is regulated. It's a regulated flow. It's like a sink. You put on a faucet, and the energy flows, and it flows.
Pipes get narrower.
Exactly. So, because the energy of Atzilus is the Eir HaKav, is the energy of the original Kav. The Kav is like the instrument, the ray of light. Kav means line, chut, the ray and thread of light. Hanim Shech Meir Ein Sof, that transmitted from the infinite divine light. Ukamaimer Shema Melagav, the EU Eirach Atzilus. Shema is Melagav, means from within. Shema is a shame of Yud Kei Vov Kei in a certain configuration. It's Shema Bittul. The EU Eirach Atzilus. This is Eirach, the length of Atzilus. Eirach means the path of Atzilus. Not Eirach with a Chof, with a Ches. Eirach. So in other words, Eirach here actually is more Eirach Atzilus. It's the presence of the path of Atzilus. Eirach. It's the identity of Atzilus, essentially. And it's known that the Kav ends, the physical, the Kav's primary energy ends in Malchus Atzilus and does not radiate in Biyah. Because the Kav is transmitted through a tzimtzum, a concealment, that transmits a diminished energy that is commensurate to the worlds. Because the energy of the kav is an energy that transmits in order to manifest in the world in an inner, an imminent, and internalized, integrated energy, and this could only be possible through the tzimtzum dafka. Without a diminishment, energy could not, the pure energy could not enter into containers and into the worlds. Even though this energy in its root and its source, its first root and source, is an immanent energy, the lefiashita mavur bedruze, according to the opinion that this drush, Ayin Beis, is following, that says that er pnimi, immanent energy, is all the way in the root. You have it in the source that has basically defined shape, because there's an opinion that holds that in the source er is shapeless. Pure shapelessness, and it only gets shape when it enters. Think of it like clear liquid in colored containers. But the opinion in this hemshach is that the air in original state has already amorphous, abstract shapes. She's asking a question. You tell me it has to go through a diminishment. Didn't we learn that the shape of existence is all the way in the root? He says, yeah, but there, it's not commensurate to the worlds. And manifesting. Commission is Barla El, the Esser Sphere of Sagnuzis, like we learned earlier. The 10 hidden spheres, Ime Yesim, Bechinus Mamala Kalaman, Bishash Mekedim, Harishin. Even though they are the root and source of Mamala Kalam, of the imminent integrated energy, the focused targeted energy, in their root and source, first root and source, Harizah Bechinus Sevim Lagabe Akav. Nevertheless, there, it's still a hovering energy compared to the Kav. Bottom line is that on one hand, yes, the shape and form of the spheres, even in the lower levels, originate before the tzimtzum, but the way they are there, they're too powerful to manifest without a tzimtzum, and relatively to the lower level of the kav, it's still a form of seviv, relative. It's only through the diminishment that this energy can transmit in this way, to be in a state of manifestation. But on the other hand, he's explaining all this to explain that what's in Atzilus is not in Biyah. So he's saying like this: on one hand, the Kav is definitely a shaped entity, but at the same time, he says its limitation is defined is only in a state where there's levels that are Lakus Mamish. So think of it of a teacher who's a teaching conveying an idea. So the ideas definitely have shape and form, and therefore it's in a diminished state. But he can only communicate it to students that are receptive to this idea. He can't go speak to people who are not interested. Biyah is not interested in elikus. Biyah is already a creature, a creation. Exactly. Well, I wouldn't say bleak vul. I would say er. It's divine energy, but divine energy in a place where there's gedusha, where there's atzilus. That's why the transmission and the manifestation of this kav, of the energy of the kav, is only to Atzilus. Because the containers of Atzilus are receptacles to Elikus. But also, as till Atzilus, the energy continues to gradations of diminish and it travels and diminishes. So, Kaneda, the Gam Atzilus, Huraka Oras HaKav. As it's known that even Atzilus, it's only the reflection of the Kav. It's not the pure Kav. As we discussed also earlier. But in Biyah, in Biyah, now you're already creating an independent entity. So you're not talking about not a student that's receptive to this Eir, the example I'm using. You can't have Amshach HaSeir HaKav, Alpi Maimer Kav Amida, according to the regular flow. So think of it like this. It's flowing through the pipe. But as long as the pipe is a fitting pipe, but now we're entering a new world called Biyah. The energy and the light, the liquid, the energy, the water in the pipe here can no longer enter according to the regular flow. Only the containers of Atzilus from there is what's transmitted in Biyah. Shenasim Naran the Biyah Kaneda. Yeah? You're going to the ice cream store, very nice. So from this energy of Atzilus, Kalim of Atzilus, not the air, from the containers of Atzilus becomes the nefesh, ruach, neshama, the soul of Biyah, like it's known. And all this, also this is not from the core containers, ki mashayidei kos hakelim, but it's only from the striking of the kelim by a parsa in the curtain, shebein Atzilus lebriya, between Atzilus and Briya, nisneitzus sparks, it creates sparks from there, Biyah. Like it's Chaim Shara Shemus, chapter 1. That's only a removed, a detached reflection from the containers. What time do we have here? I'm going to stop here probably. Yeah, I'm going to stop here because I can't do the whole chapter. Let me just sum this up. He's basically making a case why, answering the question why Epnimi, as even though it's divine energy, the bitl it brings to the world is not from itself, it's coming from the Eir Ein Sof. Because on its own, the Kav is subject to gradations and diminishment. So think of it like this. I'm writing with my pen, and my pen is creating existence. So I have letters and all that. That's the flow of creation. How much bitl can really go through my pen? Very little. Because it's being diminished. According to the regular flow of ink, the regular flow of ideas going into the pen, it's diminished, more and more diminishment. So in Biyah, you don't have what's in Atzilus. So how is there bitl, how could there be bitl introduced here? So he's going to say, is because the pen, the ink, is connected to the source. So the Eir Ein Sof, like I said before, with the water, rushes can send a surge that will introduce bitl into this. That's the case that he's building here. So in other words, back to the question before, we said Atzilus is both a pipe that brings creates and also elevates. The elevation part is really coming from beyond Atzilus. It's just traveling through this pipe. So, you know, I'm trying to find an example in health. You probably can find a good example. Let's, for argument's sake, tell me if this makes sense. Just thinking out loud here, 1 second. Let's say a person is a healthy human being, everything is flowing right. The blood is flowing through the veins, circulatory system, no pinched nerves, everything is flowing. But then, God forbid, something happens, an accident, or an illness. It stops the flow, it pinches something, it narrows it, and now you need, and you can't rely on the natural healing system, something has to be done. So you need to have something that generates, I'm just thinking hypothetically here, generates something from the source of whatever the source is, that just goes beyond the regular flow and compensates for whatever is lacking and like opens up the channels or something like that. You know, I mean, it would be best if you could say you can get the heart pumping so strong that it'll suddenly shoot so much blood through that it'll just get rid of any blocks.
On pinch.
So that's the idea. So it's still going through the pipe of Atzilus, but it requires something from a higher dimension to get the healing going. Because it's no longer... Because left to its own accord, the flow is not enough. I mean, I just don't have the words for it, but clearly healing, when you intervene and help the healing process, you're doing exactly that. You want to strengthen the immunity system.
Beating faster and there's a high blood pressure and all sorts of stuff.
So you want to create an extra abundant, that the natural flow would not be able to deal with a challenge. It could only deal with the creation, putting things into place. But if you need something additional, you need some abundant. You follow what I'm saying? I mean, I would like to find an exact example, but that's the thinking here. That's what he's saying here. You want to say something?
I think there's a few examples. But I think they have ways that, you know, they what's it called? Acupuncture, I think. So I think I heard someone recently, yesterday or something, you know, they go to the nerve, and then that, you know, that healed. Someone said about someone had a heart, bad knee. A few months later, because acupuncture, cartilage grew back or something.
Yeah.
No.
This is talking about something more internal. It's actually
right. I'm trying to think. I mean, look, in Ruchnius, I know for sure. Like for example, about Shuva or someone who made a mistake, like where they say Shtar Shiyatsu Lavir. Once there was a challenge, and then you bring and confirm it, it's far stronger than it was originally, because you're bringing a whole other dimension in. Just a fun example. I'll think of a few examples.
Psychologically, a person that has many, many issues can always flush out the issues from going beyond.
That's a good point. Flushing out is also a good word. Yeah.
Coming, if you go deeper.
For sure.
Yeah. Very good.
Anyway, bottom line is to sum it up. So that's where he's in mid-level. We'll continue tomorrow, where he's basically saying that Eir Pnimi, it's the bitl that it brings in, has to come from the Eir Ein Sof. So the first half of chapter 129, page 249, 250.